He did all kinds of things. But that didn't stop this fire. Because that isn't what the longshoremen wanted. They wanted the thing to shut down, take their 15 minutes or whatever they, I think it was 10 minutes when we started the idea with, and then go back to work.
Mm-hmm. Just like everybody else gets to do.
Just like everybody else does in the coffee break. The employer perceived that if he could keep the hook moving, he would lose no production. The coffee break would cost him absolutely nothing in production, and so therefore that's what he was after. Mm-hmm. And so there was, I wouldn't say a lot of firing. You know, it probably seemed like a lot at the time, but there wasn't massive firings. And there was lots of times gangs would go just along with what the heck the employer wanted. It depended on the gang. It depended on the militancy of the men in that particular gang. I can remember Bob St. Clair, who had a gang at the time. He's kind of a radical type guy anyhow. And he got fired pretty near every day he went to work because he made it a point.
Who's a principal?
Yeah, he made it a point, you know, and he didn't. He was a hatch tender. When he was on the winches and it was came time for a break, he shut the winches off. Certainly, he shut them off. Well, he shut them off to shut the whole thing down. They didn't just fire him; they fired the whole unit because the whole unit was shut down. And probably Bob was the cause of it. But that was the way he perceived the coffee break. And eventually, we won that in most cases. There are still jobs on the waterfront. And it will always be jobs where you don't shut anything down, where extra men are provided and hired, and you take your coffee break as it comes.
Mm-hmm. But on the whole now, the unit coffee break is the
standard. The unit break, yeah. The thing that the employer didn't want is a standard up and down the break.
What about abuse of the load limits in the early days or even today? Because now, as I understand it, by and large, the load limit is determined by safety.
Well,
in essence, before
the mechanization agreement, which did away with load limits, they had load limits of 20 sacks and so many bales of pulp and so many of this and so much poundage and so much. I've seen guys in the hold ships, not once but many times, hardworking guys, more than willing to take the extra sack. It didn't make any difference. If there was 21 sacks on a load that called for 20, they would send it back out of the hold. It was hoisted in, and they counted the sacks, you know, quickly, and said, hey, that's got an extra sack on it, take it out. They wouldn't even stow that first load. I don't think the employer did that on purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he even put the 21 sacks on just to test to see if he could get him to do it. So I don't think it meant that much to him. But that kind of thing I seen happen. And they were very staunch about that load limit. Then after the load limits were eliminated, there was a lot of problems, an awful lot of problems, with people refusing to take over what the old load limit was. And there was lots of arguments, lots of work stoppages and so on, you know, minor ones, not whole ships and things, to try to keep the load limit. I mean, they just couldn't perceive that they'd given it up. And when they did finally start perceiving the load limit, there was the second M&M contract, the second 5-year one. Mm-hmm. They drew into the contract what they called an onerous clause, which said basically that maybe it might have even been in the first one. I can't remember.
I can check it. I can't.
Well, remember. Anyway, they started really using it in the second 5-year one, and the guys would say they would be onerous, you know. And by then, they'd also established in lots of cases working on and off. Because of the way the things came in and you were able to stow them with a lift jitney and so on and so forth. And the guys, they had a hard time in their minds separating this onerousness.
The old load limits.
Well, no, from the fact that they were working hard, but four of them were gone, you know? And so they would say, hey, wait a minute, get the business agent, this is too onerous. The business agent, he'd come down to the ship and he would see four guys working with eight guys getting paid, you know? And but they'd have to work like hell. Again, something like Pedro did prior to the thing. And the onerous deal was, say, you had to argue with the employer. The employer would say, hey, how you get the men back and it isn't onerous? And the business agent, of course, he could never win something like that. Of course, he was no good because the guys down there still didn't perceive that the other four should come back. And he used to say to them lots of times that the job was truly honest, get the other four guys back and we'll argue for two more men. And sometimes he would be successful. And then five would go. As soon as the beef was all over and they start working, then five would stay and five would go. And they'd still, you know, it was kind of stupid, but that's the way they did things.
Well, I mean, in a sense it seems stupid, but wasn't part of it the whole idea that we have something to say about the conditions of our work, that, you know, we have a right, you know, to have some control over what's going on.
But in essence,
and then sometimes people sort of take the wrong issue maybe to press that point.
But in essence, it was kind of trying to marry together what was before mechanization and what came afterwards. And they had a lot to say. Before mechanization, this waterfront here, the men were hard workers and they had principles. Now maybe their principles might have even been misdirected a time or two. But if they saw something that they perceived was wrong, and it would have to be really wrong compared to what they would think now, but it was wrong, they would shut the gear off, and there was no penalty, you know. They might take some wages away from them, but they would never get the guy in a position to where you get time off the waterfront or penalized in such ways and so on and so forth. And so, combined with their principles and the fact that they were hard workers and so on, they went into this mechanization agreement. And then they couldn't shut the gear off, because if they did, they were penalized for it. You know, penalized differently than just taking a dollar or two away from it. Maybe saying, hey, you can't work for 15 days because you've had an illegal work stoppage. There wasn't such a thing as an illegal work stoppage prior to that time, at least not in the intent that you would get some penalty for it. And after the M&M agreement came in, they had to devise ways around what they were doing in order to. They didn't fully understand it. The men in the hold do not understand the longshore contract today. You know, they just pick up bits and pieces, and I would assume that I'm sure it was the same way then. And so they didn't really fully understand. And the mechanization contract was so complicated that even people that perceived to understand the contract didn't understand the damn thing. And they bought it for money, and now they were getting all these bad effects out of the thing. And so it was a real time of unrest.
When the contract, the first one, was presented to the rank and file, how was it presented? I mean, was the money what the leadership also talked about?
Well, the only guy we sent to that caucus, it was over in Hawaii, and our local was very money conscious because we didn't have much money, was Walt Williamson. And Walt Williamson came back, and I sat in the meeting when he explained it. And I was, I guess, about 31 years old.
Did you have a copy of it to look at during?
The union briefs it out in a form so that after you understand the contract, the form makes sense. Before you understand the contract, You know, it's a job of some salesmanship involved in what you're reading, you know. But the guy that goes to the caucus comes back, and anything that he can understand, he can ask at that caucus, and if he's perceptive enough to know that he should ask, he asks, or somebody else may ask, and you hear the answer to it. So you come back with a fair understanding. But Walt Williamson came back, and I like Walt Williamson, but he came back, and he really misrepresented the M&M agreement, because he, like I told you, he perceived it to be something like a Sears and Roebuck profit-sharing plan. Whereas...
You think that was his own misinterpretation, or that it had been misrepresented
to him?
No,
I think it had been misrepresented to him. I should have said that.
Because I've gotten that from other people, that they felt that Bridges was selling them something different from what they were getting, that they realized
in
retrospect.
There's a blue book running around, I'm sure.
Yeah, Collective Bargaining and Productivity, yeah. The Paul Hartman book?
No, I'm talking about the one that our research director sent. You got it, I think. I'm not sure who did the book. Lynn Farley, maybe?
Well, Frank gave me a thing on a wage chronology.
Oh, yeah, I told him. Yeah, that isn't.
That isn't.
No, there's a better one around, too. By golly, I got one, I think, down in the gear locker called The Box. But it's a good one about M&M.
Okay, because the main thing I've read is the Hartman book.
Well, anyway, there's an explanation of the M&M in this book I got at home. I just bought it. It was published by, I think, Lincoln Fairley, who was the research director for the Union at the time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you can't find anybody that takes credit for M&M now. You know, you talk to Harry Bridges, it really wasn't his idea. He was bamboozled into buying a bum package by some mystical leadership of the union that he doesn't even really know who was there. And he's a bright man, but he... It was kind of a strange thing, you know. And the employer, he had bought too many contracts that he couldn't get the advantages out of them he wanted. And the M&M, Bridges was supposed to have got the upper hand when he dealt with Paul St. Cyr. And this M&M was going to be a great thing for the longshoremen. The employer was going to get somewhat of his share out of it, but the longshoremen were really going to get the most. Well, it worked in just the opposite. For every dollar that longshoremen made on M&M, the employer made 50. And there was no way we could get to those dollars, you know. And then after the initial 2 5-year contracts, the employer said, to hell with you, we've bought all this here already, and now it's bought, and it's done for.
Now, someone was telling me, I can't remember if it was Lee or someone else, that when Harry came to town to sell the contract, people were given the impression that this big lump sum payment at retirement would go on forever. Now, do you think Harry really believed that that's what would happen?
Mm-hmm.
And it was only
he never came to town until the second contract. Harry Bridges never showed up in Tacoma until 1966.
Yeah,
he was, I think, fearful of coming here.
Wasn't sure about you guys.
Yeah, I really believe that, because he wouldn't come up. And it was quite a significant thing for us to become involved in the ILWU, and he never even came up and initiated us or nothing. He had no... He did like hell. He sent up Balky to do it. I was here when they done it.
Well, what's this one picture in here? What's this one?
That's Tony Tomatich and...
I got the impression that was when the charter was installed.
No, neither one of these guys. See, Tony Tomatich was the business agent.
I wonder if I see. No, this is...
when this charter was installed, Bulkey was here.
Now, I thought I saw an article somewhere about bridges coming up. Well, that's in 76, that's pretty old.
Pretty
but I was under, yeah, I was under the impression that this picture was involved with the installation of the charter.
No, this is Walt Williams in here. Mm-hmm. He was president in 1961.
Well,
but here, along Longshoreman at Anacortese. This here one here was when we counted the votes.
Right.
Hold on, sure. That just tells
well,
you.
Well, somewhere
they
I
sent
got the
Jermaine
Balky.
He sent Jermaine Balky up here, and Bridges didn't show up here until somewhere in the mid-60s, and I think 1966, to tell you the truth. And I can remember him being here, and I was president then, and he was talking to Beeman, and I can remember him talking to Harry, to Terry Mason. He's incidentally secretary up in the Union now. And Harry Mason was a Beeman, and he was complaining because he felt that he was sold out because he had to sign certain papers in order to become an A-man, that if work tapered off, that he could be set back to a B-man and so on and so forth. Part of the concept of M&M, which was basically to get rid of the old man first, protect the working group, and if you had to, and there was lack of work, you could set the new A-men back to B-men, and it was a sales job at taking the majority of the people and protecting
mm-hmm.
them, so they would vote for it. Bridges told him, he says, son, by the time you retire, he says, you'll get at least $20,000. Well, $20,000 in 1966 seemed like an awful lot of money.
You could buy a house for $20,000.
Oh, easily. So he, you know, he did perceive that the thing would go on forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard it from other people, too.
And in fact, I think he was frustrated in 1971, and of course the strike happened, and it was a very ineffective strike, not because the longshoremen weren't strong enough, but because of that damn wage freeze and all the rest of the bullshit that happened with Nixon in office and so on.
Do you think the part of the result of the 71 strike is that the M&M had been in effect for 10 years? And that in some sense people were beginning to realize what they'd given up, and they were, I mean, it seems to me the 71 strike was a real defensive strike.
The 71 strike, as I perceive it, was a strike mostly for strike's sake alone. Just to be able to say, we haven't been on strike for 23 years, and we're not militant anymore. We're not
uh-huh.
strong anymore.
Uh-huh.
We've got to show that employer we're strong, so we better go on strike.
But that's what I'm saying in terms of being defensive.
Yeah,
the union felt it was being pushed around.
Well, it felt that the employer perceived them as not being strong.
Okay.
It's like the guy down the block that has a good punch, but he hasn't thrown it for a long time, and nobody believes now that he's got the good punch. He knows he thinks he has. So he walks out on the street and punches somebody. And that's just about the way that happened.
Uh-huh.
But the proper time for that strike was 1966.
Uh-huh.
If we would have struck in 1966 and would have had the same intelligence we had in 1971, you know, the same understanding of what we had really went through for that 10-year period of time, we didn't have that at the end of the 5-year period of time. At the end of the 10-year, we basically had the understanding of what the employer thought he'd bought, what we thought we'd given up, but where we were really at. But if we would have had that understanding and had that strike in 1966, the employer would have never been anywhere near as strong or had anywhere near the rules and the control that he has of the radical guy in the union today, which gives him the right to discipline people, you know. In this local here, he doesn't really do that. But in up and down the coast...
He could if he wanted. I mean, he's legally got the right to if he wanted to.
Yeah, well, the place that he practices most of the things that he does that sets the trend for the industry is in San Francisco. Because in San Francisco, you have the head of the PMA, you have the head of the union, and you have a large working force there, and all the things that they want to see how they work are tried out on that group.
I know, UPS in LA was the group that got all the experiments done on them. We had the worst conditions in the entire country.
Well, the employer is basically lazy. He's just like a longshoreman, I mean, just like anybody else. He don't want to travel up to Seattle, you know, and the PMA officials don't want to travel up to Seattle to implement something, because they'd have to be away from their own homes and away from, you know, it's uncomfortable and so on. The union president and the union staff, they're very happy with him trying it in San Francisco, because they can then fight it right there when they're at home. They can go home, put their feet under their own table and sleep in their own bed and everything. So San Francisco is the logical place to have all the turmoil and all the problems. It's very tough. The difference between that and Tacoma, well, in Portland and Los Angeles and Seattle, are Portland, Los Angeles, and Seattle are prescribed as being the four major ports along with San Francisco on the coast. Well, in Tacoma, they kind of forgot about us. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't. I don't say they don't know we exist, but they know we're here. But they really aren't bothered with us. So we've got a secondary employer, you know, a different group of employers, young people that have been sent here, you know, to start someplace, older people that haven't been successful enough to climb the ladder, you know, and so on, and they pretty much leave Tacoma alone and leave us in a kind of a maverick state, or allow us to be that way. And for that reason, and what went on before when we were IBL and ILA and everybody else was ILWU, we've kind of remained a unique identity in that respect, that we don't have the same problems that they have in these bigger locals, and particularly San Francisco. So the union now here recognizes, in fact, this is the way I put it, we are not a place where a port is necessary. Tacoma is not a place where a port is necessary. Probably 5 ships a year coming into the port of Tacoma could provide all the goods that are necessary that are imported into Tacoma. Maybe that might be a bum estimation, maybe it might be 10, but I mean a very few ships. So, we compete with the major ports on the Pacific Coast, and in some cases, the major ports around the whole continental outside of the United States. And in order for us to exist, in order to have a workforce and exist, we have to have ships to work. So how do we best, the union says, how do we best proceed that we can play a part in determining how much work is here? So that's the reason that we're involved with the Port of Tacoma. That's the reason we're involved in with the employers the way we are. That's the reason we're completely different than maybe exception 1 or 2 small ports on the Pacific Coast. Because if we chase ships out of here, if we get real militant and not use our, well, not militant, we get stupid and not use the strength we have wisely, we can for strength's sake alone, like the strike was in 1971, for strike's sake alone, we can chase chips out of here and they'll never come back. There's no need for them to come here.
But what's the fine line between cooperating in order to get work and compromising conditions and...
As I see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now remember, we got the secondary employer. That's one thing. We also have the docks and facilities all ran by a public entity, the Port of Tacoma. The Port of Tacoma is not ran like a private concern.
Excuse me.
Who is that, Duncan?
Yeah.
Anyway, the fine line. So, we have a bunch of employers for the port that are different than what a private concern is in the fact that no matter how much profit their company makes, they are not part of the profit structure. You know, they're just hired by a public entity. And if the port makes $1 million more next year than this year, they don't share in that profit. So they don't have the same attitude towards the same drive towards making everything as effective or worrying about getting every dollar they can out of something as a private concern would. You know, people in a private concern with the pecking order at the top making more money if the company makes more money are going to worry more much differently about it. The secondary employer that we've got running all the stevedore companies here, he's kind of left out in the woods to a certain degree too, because the owners are not here. They're someplace else. So he puts them over in this part of the country. If they're a young, aggressive type guy, they very quickly learn that that isn't very sensible, because there's still a few old people around here and they're not aggressive. And they don't want to disturb them, because they're going to send a bum report back to the main office about them. The local is going to shut their job down or have some problem that they don't want to have, and they're fearful about all these things. So they're not aggressive like the Port of San Francisco supervision is. So here we are, we're set with a bunch of people, and basically the way I perceive a good deal of our supervision here is a guy that just wants to get through the day without having any much too much of a hassle. He doesn't really want to fire anybody. He doesn't really want to kick anybody in the ass. He doesn't want to have an argument. All he wants to do is go home at night and put his head on the pillow and say, geez, I had a fine day today, and then fall off to sleep without having any bad dreams. So as a result, the union is put in a position that they shouldn't be put in. They're put in a position where they have to kind of carry the ball. They kind of have to tell this employer, now, hey, get on some of these people. There are people, but get on their tail. They can't do that. You know, we got to have some kind of control here, because if we don't, we tell them, we ain't going to have no ships. You know? So the union has taken part of management's role in Tacoma. Management still retains some of its role. And because of the uniqueness of the Port of Tacoma, which has to be kicked in the ass to get things done, I perceive the union as the only thing that holds it all together. And I don't really like at times the role the union has to play. I would much sooner be in a position, because you're walking on a tightrope lots of times. You're wondering whether you're going to fall off the wrong side of the damn thing. You're walking down this rope, and you're saying, we've got to keep on a straight and narrow here. And it's a very particularly small little rope. And you're wondering whether you're going to do the wrong thing. You're wondering whether you're over-disciplining your own people, whether you've told management the right thing, or whether you've leaned one side or you've leaned the other. And the officials of the local are really put in a real bad position. It would be much easier to perceive like Sean Maloney does, that The employer is always wrong and the union is always right. And argue from that premise. You know, that no matter how rotten that kid is, no matter whether he's done a day's work or whether he hasn't, you go in and you protect him with every ounce of strength you can muster. That he may be the worst worker in the world, have the worst practices on the job in the world, be the most dangerous guy in the world. Disregard what that guy is doing to you and your group because the employer is your only enemy. And you have to protect that guy, that you owe that to him as a union. You'll never kick that guy in the butt because he's a union member. You can't do that in this local. That's part of walking this darn tightrope that I don't really like at times. Because it would be much easier to take that, the other stance. Take the stance that you're protecting the guy. Go down, fight. Test all the strength that the employer's got. Save the worst son of a gun that you can find. You know? Do everything you possibly can. That's an easier role to play. We got a bad role here in the fact it's kind of an enjoyable role at times, but it's kind of an unenjoyable one at times too. Because when you come here, like I did in 1955, and say they were roughly the same. When I joined the local in 1955, there was about, I think I was the 427th member of the local. There was, a few came after me. In 1964, there were, and I remember the figure there because it was the same figure that I had as a number. I mean, a number in the local of being 427. It was 427 registered longshoremen in Tacoma. That's how many there were in 1964. With all the mechanization we've had, which in my, I did, I wish I wouldn't have thrown the study away, I wish I'd have given it to you, because I did it in about 1966 and updated it a couple of times, but it didn't perceive to me that anybody ever wanted to really read it. I read it to the local, explained what was happening, and threw it away. But today, there are two longshoremen doing the work of what 10 did in 1958.
I was going to say, your membership hasn't decreased, but The amount of tonnage
that's done in this port here today, the amount of tonnage that's done in this port today, and I haven't even looked at the figure for quite a while, would be roughly five times as much tonnage as there was done in as there was being done in 1958, and the amount of longshoremen that are here, which should be five times as many according to that tonnage. But because we've shrunk in job opportunity through mechanization, there are only 400, roughly speaking, about that same amount making a living here, maybe a few more. But, you know, I believe in reading figures put out by the PMA last year that they figured that counting 1958 is one, that there was 2.297, that was the production ratio. In other words, it took hours. If 1 hour did it in 1958, the 1 hour now was done by 0.297, which is roughly somewhere between a quarter and a third amount of a man hour to do it. It was down somewhere at one time around 1 point something in 1973-74. I don't think that that's representative of this local, but it's representative of the whole coast. I think we've got a better ratio than what that two. We'd probably be down around 2.4 or 2.3.
See, the question that this raises in my mind, I mean, the whole thing with M&M and the mechanization and the effect that it has had, is that by and large, the mechanization agreement did what it set out to do for the union in terms of protecting the jobs of the number of people who were there at the time it was signed. You know, it's done a reasonably good, you know, there've been some fluctuations in some ports and stuff, but
nobody starved to death.
Yeah. On the whole, it has done that.
Yeah.
But
during this economical period.
It raises in my mind a sort of broader question, though, because a similar thing has happened in other unions where they faced automation with the idea that we will protect the people we now have. But it brings into my mind the question of what about the unions, either your union or any union or the labor movement as a whole, protecting the future jobs as well.
Oh boy, you see, that's where I'm at.
See, I mean, because now
that's
what do we have?
That's the problem.
We have 7.9% unemployment the last time I remember the figure, and it's gotten to the point where it used to be that 2-3% unemployment was considered acceptable in the sense that the economy could live with that level of unemployment and provide benefits to that level of unemployed without any serious disruption in society. Now they're talking about 5 or 6% is an acceptable level of unemployment.
Of course, you know what we're doing now. We're talking about philosophical.
Well, I know we are, but I think that, you know, if this book is going to serve a purpose, you know, other than just telling people what has happened in history, I think there's also, you know, something to be said that we have to learn from what has happened in the past too, and we have to use the past as a way to sort of think about how to deal with the future. And so
I understand what you're saying, because I've wrestled with these thoughts in my mind lots of times. The first thing you do is you want to protect number one. That's the first, you know, that's the first thoughts in your mind. How do I protect what I've got right now? That's the first thing you think about. And that's why the plan that was put forth by Harry Bridges was so effective in being sold to the working guy, because it was protecting that guy. I mean, he was no longer, you know, have to worry about it. But then when you get into the thinking of what's best for the union, well, you've got a lot of arguments with the plan, because it just isn't really what we know. What is the purpose of a labor union, and you know, and what do you intend to do? It would be like the day you and your husband got married, say you're 21 years old, and somebody said, I'll guarantee you for life every need that you're going to have, but on your death there will be nothing left. Your kids will get nothing, your grandkids will get nothing. There'd be no heritage left, no nothing. And you would take a look at it maybe at 21 years of age and buy that program. But by the time you're 40 years of age, you'll be thinking a hell of a lot different than you were at 21. Well, that's some of what happened with this here M&M agreement and all the things and all the thinking that went into the damn thing. I personally don't perceive the M&M thing as being of any value whatsoever to the union. And in fact, there isn't probably working longshoremen. There isn't any working longshoremen that really got any great value out of the M&M. None of them. Except maybe they got an easier day's work. But that would have came anyhow, even though M&M didn't. You know. We would feather bed and we would have did other things. But that would have came. The guy, the old timer that retired and did get that lump package, he paid it back anyhow because his retirement was cut down because he got that money. So I doubt if there would be too many of those people that would even want to say, I benefited at all from M&M. M&M, as far as I can see, you know, and it'll be that way down the hill further, 20 years in the future, it'll be easier to see. But I see it as only an improvement of the employer's lot in life, not of ours. And I don't mean on the level that I'm talking about. I mean, on the level that I'm living in.
In the corporate level.
Now, I'm talking about the corporate level, the top level. That's the only people. That's the only place the employer's strong, too, you know. That's another thing that I sure moved up in thinking. I used to judge the employer by these people that I told you about that wanted to put their head on the pillow and fall asleep at night without any worries and everything. And the guys that I work with, they're nice guys. They're just young kids and, well, and they're workers. They're not a hell of a lot different than what you and I are. They're not on that corporate level up here. And those people are not strong, you know. They got directives coming down to them saying, if the guy don't wear a hard hat, fire him. They got another one following behind that. Make sure they do a day's work, don't allow any work stoppages. They got another one following behind that, directing them to do something, all contrary to one another. And the guy that's sending them down is the owners in the corporate, high corporate level. And the poor guy, he's going down to the ship and he says, put your hard hat on or I'll fire you. When he knows that if he fires him, there may be a work stoppage on that ship and all kinds of trouble. And he'll get hell for not putting the hard hat on, or he'll get hell for the ship being shut down. And he's just a frustrated, poor young fellow. I mean, he doesn't know what the hell to do, and I don't even know how to help him. I feel sorry for him lots of times because he's in that position. But as far as M&M is concerned, I think that it's of no value to us whatsoever. And in fact, we're in the process, the union is in the process, with its thinking of trying to turn around some of the things that M&M have done. And in fact, I would say we did a pretty good job of it here just recently, and we demonstrated it with Weyerhaeuser. They came up with a bar called the Grant Bar that was going to eliminate 4 longshoremen off of a whole job, off of a log job, which would have only left, cut it right in half. It was a new device that was radioactive, activated by a radio beam, and the guy carried a button strapped around him and so on and blah, blah, blah. But the longshoremen finally took a stand, and I think a right one, where they said, we don't give a damn what you hang on that hook. We aren't going to work if you cut our men down. We're just simply not going to do it anymore. We've had it, you know. And the employer, of course, he's got all kinds of things. And now we're talking about the corporate level, not the guy that wants to go to sleep. They got all kinds of reasons. They say, we're doing it for you. After all, where are most of your men hurt? They're hurt in the hole on logs, you know. And if we get those men out of the hole, then there's not going to be any more accidents. So that was what we were thinking about. We weren't thinking about saving half the money we're spending. You know, that didn't bother us, and we're more interested in your livelihood. And now, you know, we don't want anybody hurt. And, you know, all the rest of the crap that goes along with it. When it all comes down to dollars and cents, and that's all they're interested in. And truthfully, if it's cheaper to kill a guy than it is to change something, they'll kill you. It's just that simple. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but that's the way it is.
UPS definitely had that attitude.
Well, power and light companies, the procedures that they have, you see them out there with 4 or 5 guys around the bottom of the pole, one guy up there, you know, and all these guys watching for everything that's happening. If there was no insurance on that guy up on that pole and it didn't cost nothing to kill him, they'd have one guy down there handing him things. They wouldn't have the 4 or 5 guys down there making sure that everything was safe.
Well, you know, the telephone company, they just had that wildcat over. The telephone company was trying to take the second person out of the manholes. You know, and the telephone workers just said, no way, you know, leave us down there by ourselves.
I have a brother that's a supervisor for the telephone company. And he used to be in the union, and I used to school him a lot. He's a younger brother, and I used to tell him what to say and what to do, and I used to get him in a lot of trouble, but now that he's in the other end of the business, he don't see my end too well anymore. He kind of forgot where in the hell he came from and how he got there. In fact, his daughter went through a picket line the other day, and that during that thing, they set up picket lines all over, and she just got a job at the telephone company. And she went through the picket line. And I told him, I says, you know, I says, Tom, that's a bad thing. And I later found out from his wife that he bawled her out for going through the picket lines. The kid didn't know any better. She's only 18 years old, and she's her first job, and she didn't understand it. Nobody bothered to explain it to her. Now she's got a bunch of people mad at her. She don't understand that. But her dad bawled her out, and I was kind of happy with that because he still remembers at least some of it, what I used to talk to him about. But this is all philosophical.
But I think that certain philosophical background is important. I mean, that's... employers certainly have a philosophy about what they're doing. I mean, we see it as a real simplistic philosophy, make more money. You know, but it is a philosophy.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And at least it's my perception of the unions today have, even though they sort of spout a lot of the same rhetoric, underneath it all, their philosophy has changed in some sense.
Unions, basically unions don't really give a shit about the unemployed people.
That's
basic.
But that's now. I don't think 50, 60, 70 years ago unions had that same attitude about the unemployed. Or at least not some sections of the labor movement. And the CIO did a lot of organizing among the unemployed.
But I think that basically if you went back to that period of time, you would find, just like now, that 10% of the union people do 90% of the work. I think at that time, the things you read about, you would find that there's 90% that you don't read about that were standing back there enjoying the fruits of the labors of the 10 that were willing to
The fight between the AFL and the CIO was a classic battle that's been going on in the labor movement, you know, for years and years, you know, for decades. That same fight, the sort of difference between protecting what you've got and keeping it to yourself, which was the sort of traditional view of the AFL and the skilled trades, and what at least at the time was the CIO's point of view, was that unions have a social function. They serve a purpose for society as a whole, not just for their own membership. You know, that they're responsible in some sense all of society.
You see, though, but you know, I hear people preach what you're just saying, you know, that unions are that way, but I don't see anybody, and I look around an awful lot, I don't see anybody, and maybe I should look a little bit harder, maybe I can say this, but I really don't see anybody that isn't really generally the way, just the opposite, that they worry about what they've got. They want to keep what they've got, and they're not really willing to give up any of that. That's a battle I have within myself. I mean, it isn't just, you know, if somebody came along to me and said, Philip, I'm going to give you $5 an hour in this economy we've got right now, but along with giving you $5 an hour, I'm going to give everybody else $5 an hour. The unemployed, everybody is going to get the same amount of money. They're all going to be able to live just as good as you are. You're going to take an awful long look. That's quite a drastic thing I just said, but draw it in a little more proportionate, maybe. You're going to take an awful long look at what you're giving up to give somebody else something. Mm-hmm. And it isn't that clear what a union person or what a union group of people that form a union are doing. But that's about the way you have to perceive it. Now, Sean Maloney is one of the best union men I've ever seen. You know, he really is. He fought on picket lines. He's a tough-thinking, tough guy. He's he's got all the right things, but yet he values money an awful lot. He's got a few houses, he's got a few bucks in the bank, he's pretty well taken care of old Jean. Now, I don't even like to think about this part of him at all. But deep down, someplace inside of him, he saw fit at times to make damn sure that Sean was taken care of. Walt Williamson, much more of a job than Sean ever done. He's taken care of. He's a millionaire today, see? And when you start looking at those things, you find that even deep-rooted in people that you think have did a hell of a good job, there are always these things and these worries about taking care of number one that they're fighting with in their overall philosophy, see? Harry Bridges, I've heard Harry Bridges give speeches against raising his own wages when he was making less money than I was. Mm-hmm. And yet he was the only one that would get up at a convention and talk against the race, and I've seen him be successful in stopping it, you know. But yet, when he got to be about 70 years old, I've seen a pile of money from his retirement and everything piled upon him and given to him that I saw him damn glad to accept, and it really bothered me. I figured at that time that with all those people that were reaping this money upon him, giving him cars and giving him, you know, the fruits of a large banquet, you know, for held for him with an extra $50 per plate given to him or something like that, I figured that was the time that guy should really stand up and be counted, because I seen him, he didn't, you know, I knew he was counted, and I saw him stand up myself. But here he was in front of all these damned employers, you know, and all these here people that really meant an awful lot, you know, to society, not to me, but to society, where he could have said, oh, this was a great banquet you gave me, but keep your damn money. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. If you want to do something for me, do it for these people that are working for you. Do it for these people that are unemployed. You know? Mm-hmm. And he didn't do that. And it bothered me. And shouldn't have, maybe. And he's entitled. Don't misunderstand me. He was entitled to what they gave him. See? But even he, even at that time, he saw fit to take the money. And you know,
no, see, I mean, I agree that the unions today are really looking out for number one, in the sense that only for their own people and also for themselves as an institution. You know, that in fact, in some unions it's worse than others, and I would say the Teamsters is, you know, steel workers are another example, that in fact all the leadership is really trying to protect is the institution. You know, their position within the institution, and that the only reason they ever do anything for their membership is because they have to in order to protect their position in the institution.
Of course, their membership goes along with a good deal of that.
Sometimes. Not always.
Well, not each and every individual, but...
You know, and there's a, you know, like the Sadlowski campaign and the Teamsters for Democratic Union stuff. So there are attempts being made.
Them small attempts. You know,
most of them small attempts. But I would argue that, I mean, that's been going in its worst phase. It's been going on for, you know, 15, 20 years. But that just like, you know, things were very quiet in the 20s, in the unions, and the AFL, you know, was in some sense, it was a somewhat comparable time. It was difficult to organize. The unions were sort of under attack most of the time, and that kind of stuff. But out of that, when, you know, the economy fell apart and everything else, you got, again, something like the CIO. You know, and I think that we're in a period where, because the unions have gotten the way they are, and because the economy is so unstable, that you're going to begin to get, you know, that kind of social responsibility philosophy is going to start resurfacing.
But I don't think, I think the labor unions are all here. You know, they're all here. And I think what you're going to see happen, this is, again, I don't, you can't put this in the book because I don't want any part of it in there. But I don't think, I think we're going to see a change in our form of government more than we're going to see changes in labor unions, because I think labor unions have became part of the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And they have protected the people that are in them, and the people that are in them now are not going to protect anybody else. So now we've got a group of people that are going to look to something else
mm-hmm.
for that protection, and I think that what they're going to look to is some type or form of change of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and
yeah,
I think you can,
and
I think you can see that, you know, this is just again my own ideas, I think you can see that, that whenever an unusual, he doesn't have to be a great candidate, but an unusual candidate such as this Anderson steps forward, you're seeing more and more and more people rally behind somebody like that. And the reason they are is they're looking for what they were looking for in the Depression. They were looking for labor unions to do this, and they haven't done it. You know, they offered some semblance of that, but they didn't. They didn't offer what the people were expecting them to offer. And they're always looking for that. And I think this time they're looking towards the government, the change of government. That doesn't mean we're going to be communists or socialists or whatever we're going to be, but they're looking for somebody that's going to give them some of this. What they're really looking for is cradle to the grave protection of some kind. And I think that it's going to come, and I think with a little bit of luck, and not that Anderson will ever get elected, because I certainly don't agree with his philosophies on a lot of things, but I think he's going to get a lot of votes.
Mm-hmm.
And if he gets a lot of votes, that's going to shake up these two major parties we got, and they're going to start worrying about these votes and where in the hell they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that are giving them to them are not union people. You know, the labor unions have fell into being part of the establishment. Hell, they're basically Democrats,
mm-hmm.
but they joined in their philosophy, and they've joined the Democratic Party, and they've given bucks and stuff to candidates.
But don't you have to make a distinction, though, between the leadership of the unions and the membership?
Yeah, the leadership of the unions, I think, are better than the membership is. You know, at least as I perceive it. I should say that about all unions. I should just concentrate on the Longshore Union. In the Longshore Union, the people that run the union, I don't mean this local here, but run our international, are basically, their philosophy is a lot closer to what you and I would perceive a labor union should be than the guys that are rank and filers. And in that case, and in that particular case, in this union, the rank and file runs the union. And those guys at the top get shoved into positions that they don't even want to be in, simply because the rank and file goes to conventions and caucuses and so on, and philosophy and for publication to other people, they have a hell of a good platform over here that they ain't going to put any effort into, and they got their union agreements and stuff that better the rank and file that they put all the effort they can put into, you know. They got something for show and something for gold. And that's what I perceive. But if Jimmy Herman, things I don't like about Jimmy Herman, but if you were to allow Jimmy Herman, with what I've heard him say, and I've heard him talk against, and I've seen him try to do, if you would just let him run this labor union the way he wanted to, we wouldn't be near as well off financially, individually, but we'd be better off morally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Teamsters, that might be different. You know? but I'm quite sure that you find, you know, some people with good principles even running Teamster locals. They may have to become part of the establishment in order to get to run those locals, but they still haven't lost the idea, you know, ideas of basically what a union should be and what it stands for and so on and so forth. I'm sure there are guys that have. Sean Maloney would never. I mean, he would, Sean Maloney, even though he's got a few bucks in the bank and those things I talk about, told you about, and I've never said that to anybody else, incidentally. That's just something I've seen. But Sean would never, on the show and tell part over here, Sean would give up every dime he got to, so that he wouldn't ever lose the image that he thinks he's worked his whole life for. He wouldn't like to do it.
Well, no, he would.
But he would do that. Walt Williamson, I know he wouldn't do that. Walt would, if he had Walt Williamson, he'd be over here with the dollars. I mean, you know, and yet he's a good guy too, in lots of ways. He serves a lot of purposes.
There was something I was going to get back to, and now I forgot what it was. Well, maybe what we should do is we just end it here for now, and as I think of more things.
I want to tell you about how I got to.
Oh, that's right. You were going to tell me about the book. Okay. Tell me about that.
Well,
so I got the story straight.
Well, maybe everybody will tell you the story. Back about 1900, about the time of the strike in 1971. I used to hear a lot of bad things about the labor union from people that I, you know, not about labor unions, but about the longshoremen because they were on strike, from people that I'd known since I was a little kid, and it used to bother me. You know, they would say things and they would, you know, and they weren't informed. They didn't understand what they were talking about, but they would nevertheless say them and they would bother me. And And I would try my damnedest to explain to them, you know, what was going on, you know, and why it was being done the way it was, and what was happening, and what the union guy thought he had, and I was all hung up with that, like this deeply religious guy that just found religion. And so they never understood me. They don't understand the deeply religious guy either. They didn't understand me. So I thought, well, you know, somewhere along the line, just like you perceived when you went to high school, there's got to be some gosh damn information given to people at a level where they will assimilate it into their head about what the working man is all about, and what you know, what his desires and what his beliefs and why labor unions are there and why they, you know, what they supposedly do, and blah 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 blah, and. About that time, about a year later or so, I got in on a committee that was called the Shoreline Management Act Citizens Advisory Committee for the city of Tacoma. It had to do with reevaluating all our shorelines, and it was basically a good thing, I guess. Although it came with me a fight between myself and the environmentalists, which I didn't particularly like. But again, here is the worker portrayed as some kind of a destroyer, you know, right along with the employer in this particular case, because he has to be put in that position in order to want a job, I guess. And then I see my kids coming home from school telling me that aerosol cans are blocking out the sun, and this was before, of course, that they proved there was any great degree of that happening. Mm-hmm. So on, and the kids just taking teachers' advice about, you know, what, and really getting hung up on these things, you know. And I thought, gosh damn, if they do that and they can do it that way, why couldn't somehow we get something into the school system that would tell how in the hell a worker thinks and what he wants and what his desires in life are, and let that gosh damn school teacher tell those kids about that, so that when they don't get out, when they get out of school, that they don't just look at being a millionaire, and that's the only desire they've got, but they look at, you know, some of the other things, like the fragile things that we're talking about in the environment, which were in this group. So then I went to Canada in the 75 convention, and they were selling books that they had written up there. Damn poor book, too. I bought one, and I lent it to somebody, and that's the last I seen it, but that always happens. But it was basically old P.V. Ed came to the Vancouver area in 1891, and P.V. Ed's son, Bullhead Ed, is still here, and, you know, that it really didn't mean nothing. It didn't give anything about what I should think would be put in a labor book. It was more or less a family tree of the damn local, is what it really was. But they got a grant from the government, and all the rest is BS, I later found out, and they did all this here. I thought, well, you know, maybe we could write a book in Tacoma. But then it was just an idea in the back of my head, and it was popping around. I knew I couldn't write a book. I mean, you know, I knew that it was hard to do. I also never gave much thought to money, about money doing it at that time. But I came back here, and the more I read, the more I monkeyed around with that stuff, and the more I talked to three or four different people, not necessarily in the local, the more I thought it was a good idea. Somehow we could, if we could just get a book written about the Tacoma waterfront and get it into all the public libraries. Well, hell, everybody and their brother would want to read that book. I'm sure that it'd be checked out on, you know, that isn't quite so. It isn't going to work that way. But at that time, I was kind of hung up with that idea that I thought, well, that was where you start, you know. So then, what the hell, maybe 77 or so, I decided that, you know, I talked to enough people in the local about it by then, that I got up in front of the meeting and I says, well, you get on one of those spur-of-the-moment ideas that this is the way you're going to do it. There's not going to be no work in doing it. It's just all going to fall into place. You're not going to have to do nothing. You're not going to have to go to meetings or sit down and talk to you for 3 hours or whatever it may take, or any of these things that all happen. So I got up and I says, you know what I think we ought to do, I says, is write a book about the Tacoma waterfront, about our union, and about the unique, and I think it is unique, and I told you about this tightrope and all that BS, but how we've worked with management and how we've been able as a labor union to play an important part in how the Tacoma waterfront is, you know, how it grows and how it works and how ships come in here and all the rest. And I said, you know, then people would read that book and kids would, and they'd perceive us as being something unique, not unique because they wouldn't understand that, but they would perceive the laboring man as being something other than just a guy with dirty clothes and dirty hands and so on and so forth. So I said, I think we should write a book, and I said, we should form a committee and write the book. Oh, hell, there's nothing to it. So they passed that, and of course, one bright son of a gun says, well, how much is it going to cost? And that's when I said, $10,000. And that's when they said, go ahead. Now, they never gave me no money. I didn't ask for any money. I told them I'd come back to them. And I put Bill Bridges, who whenever I picked a committee, I always put Bill Bridges on it, because Bill Bridges is a good worker, not because he's that bright, but he'll always pitch in with both hands. And I can't remember who the other guy is that I put on it, because Bill Bridges is the only one that came along and did anything. And I thought, well, you know.
Was that when he started putting together the scrapbooks?
No, he had already started, but he had. That scrapbook idea, it was his idea, but I helped him with it quite a bit, because by then I was hung up on saving all these old things, and I stood around that local for 15 years and watched them throw stuff away, and it had no value to me. I wish the hell I would have stopped them 15 years sooner, but I didn't. Anyway, so then I thought, well, son of a gun, who can we get to do this work now? It looks like it's going to be a lot of work. Old timers, the retired guys, they ain't got nothing to do anyhow. You know, they'll all jump in, you know. And as soon as I talked to the old timers, particularly I talked to a guy named Les Clemenson, who I thought would be real enthusiastic, but he only seemed mediocrely enthusiastic about it. But I knew he was the kind of guy, he was like Bill Bridges. If you can get him to do it, even though he may not be as interested as you are, he would do it, he would work. Then I went around and I talked to other ones, and pretty soon I got a hold of Frank Reichel. And Frank Reichel's another one of these guys that's like Bill Bridges. He may not be the brightest guy in the world, but boy, he'll work like hell, you know, when he gets his teeth into something. And I never ever figured that Tiny would really be very interested in the thing, because Tiny, even though I knew Tiny was a wealth of information, Tiny is not the kind of a guy that puts out a lot of effort for anything. He likes to bullshit, he likes to talk about things, and he was real active when he was young. But I seen him when I worked with him down here, he worried a lot about Tiny, he didn't worry as much about other things.